This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Olympics are filled with stories of struggle and triumph. Just ask NBC. They'll tell you about it every night in primetime. But we're going to begin our show this week with a story about the struggles and the triumphs that came first and helped pave the way for my favorite teams in my favorite event, the U.S. and Canadian women's ice hockey teams. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Reggie and Renee Baker grew up in North Lansing, New York, not far from Cornell University, where their father was a professor. Here's Renee. She's Renee Baker Sandstead now.
It was in our blood to play hockey. My dad was a huge Cornell hockey fan.
He had us all as kids playing ice hockey on the pond down behind the house.
This is Reggie, now Reggie Robbins.
He would shovel it off once the ice was hard enough to hold a tractor.
Every Sunday, the local boys would come to play, and my sister Reggie and I would also play too.
Were you and Reggie the only girls?
Yes, we were the only girls that played.
So did people think you were weird?
No, we were just the kid sisters that were probably a nuisance. But, you know.
Of the two hockey-playing Baker girls, the older sister, Reggie, was always the better player.
I would go down at night after I got home from school, and I would just practice and practice with the puck. And then in the summer, I was on the driveway with a hockey stick and a tennis ball. I just knew from very, very young that I was going to start the team at Cornell. I just never doubted that.
So that was like part of the plan of why you wanted to go to Cornell, the whole thing?
The only reason. That was my life.
When Reggie was still in high school, she asked her science teacher, Gail Murphy, if she'd be willing to coach a team at Cornell. She said yes.
So we hung up flyers all over Cornell. I wasn't even accepted yet at Cornell.
In the fall of 1971, they ran their first hockey practices on the football field.
We were just running steps.
It was excruciating.
This is Penn Mapes Cook. Soon after she arrived on campus in 1971, her roommates saw one of Reggie's flyers. They knew that Penn was a hockey fan, but she and most of the other women who joined the team had never actually played. You'd ice skated before, right?
Very little. I really did learn to skate on the team.
Penn had to learn everything about the game.
Oh, simple things like watch their eyes, don't watch the puck. Just everything. You know, I knew about putting the puck in the net, but that was about it.
But first, the team would have to get on the ice. There was only one rink in Ithaca back in 1971. Reggie says it was October or November before she even asked for ice time.
Jean, who ran the line of rink, said, well, no, you know, you're not a varsity team. He said, you have to go to the athletic department. So I made an appointment and went with Gail Murphy. We went down.
This had been Reggie's dream for as long as she could remember. She never considered the possibility that the school wouldn't say yes.
And we got in there and they said, no, no, you absolutely can't have a team. It wasn't so much prejudice as it was just women can't do it. Women aren't capable. So I was really ready to start arguing with them. And Gail took me by the arm and she pulled me out of the room and she said, you're going to have to accept you gave it your best, but it's not going to happen.
Reggie immediately went to her father's office. Remember, he was a professor at Cornell.
And I just started crying, and he looked at me. He didn't even know what was going on. He didn't know why I was crying so hard. And when I finally settled down enough to talk, he said, okay, sit here for a minute, you know, sit here, and I'll be back. So he left the office for an hour. And then he came back, and he said, the athletic department wants to talk to you again, Reg. Johnny Hutter, who was the head of the athletic department, said, Reggie, Reggie, why'd you leave so quickly? We weren't done talking yet. Well, we were.
You hadn't misinterpreted.
No. But he said, yes, you can have the team. And to this, I don't know what my dad said. I don't know when Cornell would have had a real team if it hadn't been for him.
Even with varsity status, Cornell had a long way to go before they'd play like a real team.
And how was your first game? How did it go?
We're not going to talk about that.
Okay.
So potentially the score I've read is correct?
Yeah, if it's really...
I think I read 14-1.
No, it's 14-0, I believe.
Before long, Cornell was winning games, lots of them. And at least from Reggie's perspective, her school had started a trend.
Teams started springing up everywhere, but I don't think many of them went varsity right away. It was really Cornell. They were wonderful. Cornell was wonderful.
The story I'd heard, the one that led me to reach out to the Baker sisters, was that 2 years after Reggie successfully convinced Cornell to start a hockey team, she convinced her younger sister, Renee, to start a team at Boston College. But Reggie says,
she did that on her own. I was totally absorbed with Cornell hockey.
Here's how Renee remembers it.
I was planning to go to a school out in Ohio, but Reggie started encouraging me to go to a school that might start a women's team because there wasn't much competition for the Cornell women.
Renee says it must have been difficult for her sister to start the program at Cornell. But from her perspective, watching from afar, it looked like fun.
And so Reggie and I went to Boston for the ECAC finals for the men's hockey, and Boston College beat Cornell. And I said, I'm going to go apply at that school. I think that might be a place I could start a team. And that's honestly the reason I went to Boston College.
I ran this version of events by Reggie. She says she doesn't remember, but if her younger sister says it, it must be true. But Renee Baker soon found that Boston College, which had only become fully co-ed 3 years earlier, wasn't ready for something as radical as a women's ice hockey program. Renee approached the athletic department, and they sent her to see a woman. She might have been the head of the women's sports programs.
Her first name was Bobby, but I can't think of her last name now. She really felt as though I wouldn't get any interest. I told her that I would start some organizational meetings and come back to her with a list of people that were interested.
Before long, Renee had compiled a list of 25 women who wanted to play ice hockey. There was just one problem.
None of them had any ice hockey backgrounds. Most of them were figure skaters.
So I read in the school paper that your first few weeks of practice were just basic skills and hockey knowledge. Is that fair?
That's very fair. That's very fair. I can remember our very first game we played. They dropped the puck in the center, and the other team, I can't remember who it was, hit the puck, and it went very slowly down towards the goalie and went right in the goal. We were a little rough around the edges, for sure.
The school stood by its decision not to fund a varsity team, but Renee and her teammates were allowed to continue as a club.
But we still weren't getting any support, so we had to do fundraisers because we at least needed some knee pads. They did give us jerseys that were discards from the men's hockey team, but no helmets and no protective gear at all.
This was 1973, the year after Title IX, the federal law mandating equal opportunities for men and women in sports, was passed. So Renee marched down to the Equal Opportunity Office. But since her team was officially a club, she was required to invite university staff. And since she had staff on the team, the Equal Opportunity Office didn't feel that this was an issue they needed to address. It was a logic loop that Renee couldn't fight her way out of.
This went back and forth for 2 years. At this time now, we were playing against teams that would come out on the ice with, you know, full uniform and helmets and mouth guards, and we were in our sweatpants, our figure skates. I mean, I know I ended up at the hospital twice for being hit in the face with a puck.
One of those teams getting full support from their university was the one Renee's older sister had started, Cornell. They held the first women's ice hockey invitational in 1973. Boston College attended.
Everybody stayed at my house because we didn't have money, you know, to stay anywhere else. And we came in cars. We didn't come in a bus or anything. And the team felt they were in awe at how Cornell came out in these bright red uniforms and, you know, just looked so spiffy, and we were in, you know, we looked very bedraggled next to them. Some of the times when I would make a breakaway and head for the goal, they would start cheering for me, and because they were just felt so bad for us.
But it's not pity that Reggie remembers feeling.
Seeing her skate, it was, yeah, it was really cool.
She says that you and members of your team would, like, cheer for her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. She was a baker. Yeah.
Renee says that by the end of her time at BC, she was more of an onlooker than a player. So no one was more surprised than Renee Baker when, in 1976, the BC women's ice hockey team awarded its MVP trophy and called it the Baker Cup.
Marty, the coach, really wanted to let everybody know, you know, who had started the team and who had fought to make this team happen, because it was a battle. It was really a battle.
Last summer, Reggie Baker, now Robbins, went back to Cornell for a reunion of the women's hockey program.
It was incredible to see the locker rooms they have now and the equipment they have now. I couldn't believe it. I felt so honored to be there and see that what had started 45 years ago was going even stronger now.
But Renee Baker Sandstead's memories of playing hockey at BC are more complicated. She moved away after graduation. Over the next two decades, she checked in with the team from time to time to ask if they'd been made varsity yet. Every time, the answer was no.
I felt as though I was not a success, that I did not succeed in what I had hoped to achieve.
Boston College finally started a varsity women's hockey program in 1994, but by then, Renee had stopped checking in. And then, last fall, Boston College played a game at Syracuse, and Renee drove up from North Lansing to watch. It was the first time she'd seen her alma mater on the ice as a varsity team.
I must have just been beaming the entire time. I was so proud to see them.
Did the women on the ice know who you were and your story?
No. No, I had contacted the coach, and I had told her I was going to be there, and she didn't really invite me to. I would have loved to just stepped into the locker room and just shook hands with some of these women, but I didn't want to push myself on them.
Renee's role in founding the team, the Baker Cup, all of that was written up in the student newspaper back in the 1970s. But when I got in touch with the Boston College Athletic Department, they said they had no records from before the women's hockey team turned varsity in 1994. The team has not awarded an MVP trophy, Baker Cup or otherwise, during those 24 seasons. But this story isn't over yet, because the Baker sisters are both watching this women's Olympic hockey tournament with pride. If all goes according to expectations, and there's no reason to think it won't, it'll be the U.S. versus Canada in the finals next week. And as it happens, the U.S. women's hockey team has five current or former Boston College players on its roster. The Canadian team lists five from Cornell.
It sort of brings together my sister's work and my work. Oh my gosh, I'm excited for the Cornell women. I'm excited for the BC women.
Our story on the hockey-playing Baker sisters, now known as Renee Baker Sandstead and Reggie Robbins, was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. After fleeing Nazi Germany with her family, Imogene Fish went to the 1952 Olympics as a member of the U.S. ski team. Her parents were proud.
I think they were more interested in me going to the Olympics and perhaps beating some of the German skiers than they were anything else.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Jim H. Foster for leaving the following review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. This is a sports show that assumes you have a brain and also like sports. Even if you don't normally like sports, you should try it. I try never to miss it. Thanks, Jim H. Foster, and thanks to everyone who's left a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places that accept reviews. They really do help other listeners find our show.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I might not be the best, but I'm the most fun.
That's Adam Rippon, who helped the U.S. win bronze in the team figure skating event in South Korea, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by WBUR Shira Springer and by Will Leach, senior writer for MLB.com. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, sir.
Shira, you're up first.
Okay, I am declaring right now that Adam Rippon is the winner of the Winter Olympics. Why? Because he has won over fans and media members with his candor, really. I mean, he's been honest about what it's like to be an openly gay athlete. He's been honest about this crazy starvation diet he went on a couple years ago, where I think he was having 2 pieces of toast, 6 cups of coffee a day, and training on that. And he's just been honest about the whole experience. They asked him to do a play-by-play of his first skate on Olympic ice, and he admitted that for about the first 30 seconds, he felt like vomiting. We need more Olympic athletes like Rippon. They don't have to be as much of a showman, and they don't have to be as candid as Rippon has been about just about everything. But it would be nice to see them be themselves and not feel that pressure to be the Olympic athlete that either fans or sponsors or advertisers expect.
Will, are you similarly captivated by Adam Rippon?
Well, unlike Rippon, I am neither the best nor the most fun. So I can only speak from the outside. He's been so much like this is the fun of the Olympics, right? You know, I went to Sochi 4 years ago, which was much warmer, by the way, than South Korea appears to be. It looks horrible there. We went to the beach when we were in Sochi. And one of the most fun things about interviewing Winter Olympic athletes, as opposed to interviewing professional athletes here, is professional athletes, because they're interviewed all the time, and every time they say something interesting, they usually get torn apart for it, mm-hmm. are much more guarded. But the fun of me at the Winter Olympics are people like him, where this is the spotlight. Once every 4 years it comes on them, and they're ready for it and ready to embrace it as themselves. It's been a very exciting thing to say. I wish all athletes could be like that. I understand why they're not, but it's certainly something exciting thing to see.
One of the things I liked about Adam Rippon is he not only talked, Shira, as you said, about this crazy diet that he was on, he also acknowledged that he went to In-N-Out Burger and ate plenty of
when he didn't make the Olympics in 2014, right? He's sitting on the roof with Mirai Nagasa.
Absolutely. He had me when he said that he didn't want his Olympics to be about Mike Pence, because I don't want my Olympics to be about Mike Pence either. And now it's just going to be interesting to see if Mr. Rippon's taxes are audited or if he's delayed for a couple of days at the airport when he tries to come back to the U.S. And we'll all tune in for that, I suppose.
You know, when Adam had me, he had me when there were some haters out there and he decided to tweet, and I will do a sanitized version of his tweet, but he tweeted to the haters, he said, "Listen, the Glamazon is ready for the runway." And you got to love a guy with spirit like that.
Sticking with the Olympics, I want to say I'm glad that North Korea is represented at these games. I'm happy that the women's hockey team includes players from both Koreas. And I've heard criticism of the North Korean cheerleaders. Their presence is all about propaganda. I'm glad that they're there, too. They are disciplined and they are closely watched by their minders, but their presence reminds us that North Koreans are people. They're not cartoon villains. They're not cartoon victims. Their head of state is bizarre and dangerous. And there is a monstrous gap between the wealthy elite in that country and the mass of people who don't have enough to eat. But the case of the cheerleaders still, Yes, maybe they are spreading propaganda historically. That's one of the things that always happens at the Olympics. Will, are you with me on this, or would you like to have seen them stopped at the border?
Listen, we as Americans would never want to go out and talk about how we are different than our leader. Please know that we're different than our leader. So for me, I agree with you. The idea that there is personality there. And listen, this is a country that, you know, I am sympathetic to the idea that certainly I think to a lot of people that cheerleaders like this funny meme story. But what's actually going on in North Korea is so terrifying. Like, it's so rare that we get a moment where we get to see any of them. But for me, the fun of it is, yeah, they're human beings. They're silly. They're promoting their country in a way that is probably better than their country actually is, which again is what Americans are doing while they're over there.
Absolutely.
So I don't mean to make an equivalent between the two, but certainly I find it hard to look at that and be like, wow, that's a problem. I feel like the problem goes beyond just outside that.
So I am mostly with you. I like the idea that you have these cheerleaders out there that humanize North Korea in a different way than their leader. But I also think, and I know this from covering five Olympics, that when you are on site at the Olympics, reporters have some responsibility to get beyond the propaganda. So I would hope that the major news outlets that are there covering the Olympics do stories, and they are doing stories, about the politics on the Korean Peninsula. And I think that's a must, whether you're in Sochi and you're talking about Putin's politics, or in Rio, another case of economic disparity there, and, you know, the favelas. I think, yes, it's great to have those cheerleaders present, but the media has to be there and report on all that goes on with the Olympics.
Will, you are last and certainly never least.
I'm always least, Bill, but thank you. So I'm going to make a switch from the Olympics over to the NBA. I have a column in the next issue of New York Magazine about how one of the glories of the NBA this year is this is a league that's all about beef and drama, and players are always fighting. Remember, baseball is a sport where if you are happy, you are supposed to cover your face with your glove so nobody actually lets you express yourself. It's actually like standard practice to do that. And in football, they cover themselves with a helmet. I love the NBA, particularly because A, they've embraced the individualism of the players, but B, they've embraced beefs. It's like a Real Housewives episode. The subplots are all about who's feuding with who. Sometimes it's players on different teams feuding with one another. I loved when Enes Kanter called a Suns player, said he had that retirement body. Like, that's just kind of a great thing to say. Yes. About another player. And players on the own team are fighting with each other. The big story of this last month of the season has been the Cleveland Cavaliers all fighting with each other to the point that they all had to trade half the team just to make sure people were getting along. There are punches thrown. It's all generally harmless. For me, this is something that has added an extra fun subplot to the NBA season. It kind of needs it because, frankly, looks like it's going to be Cavaliers and Warriors again in the NBA Finals. It's just fun for me to see that half of the enjoyment people get out of NBA games is, oh man, that was a burn. That was a total burn. He's going to be so upset. It's reality television on the NBA. I think it's wonderful.
Shira, are you likewise fascinated by the peripheral action going on around the NBA?
Oh, I'm in complete agreement and loving every minute of this ongoing season-long soap opera. This, by the way, is sort of, to me, the Cult of Personality edition of Three Stories. And, you know, I know, Bill, you said it's sort of a peripheral thing, but it actually does affect the play. I mean, you have a guy like Russell Westbrook who gets mad and then goes out and scores 46 points.
I'm going to have to take your word for all of this, and what fun I'm going to get to disagree, because I acknowledge it. I watch basketball for the, you know, the good play, the dunking, the long shots.
But you can have that too with your soap opera.
And the problem is that I'm mostly speaking out of ignorance, because I have to acknowledge I've never watched an episode of Real Housewives. So I have no context for what you're saying. So I'm going to stick with the basketball. I enjoy it. It seems to me that's enough. But if the rest of you and everybody listening is enjoying all this soap opera stuff, terrific. Have a good time with it. Right, Will?
Yeah, to me, I love – Shira's exactly right, the idea that it is actually going on the court, the idea that Westbrook wants to have a great game because someone insulted him. So just keep that in mind, Bill. The next time that we come on, just right before we go on, just be like – Will, you got no radio game. You got no radio game, and I'm going to bring it. And I'm going to bring it. I'm going to show you. I'm going to posterize you, as is the parlance in NBA.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been WBUR Shira Springer. She also contributes to the Boston Globe, and MLB.com's Will Leach. He hosts The Will Leach Show on Sports Illustrated TV. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
An honor, as always.
In her youth, Imogene Fish was a very good skier. She learned to ski in New Hampshire, a place with which, until 1940, she and her family were completely unfamiliar.
I was born in Germany, in Berlin, in 1932. And because of some Jewish background in my father's side of the family, they decided we needed to get out of Germany, and we left there in 1940.
The decision was easy. One night, the Gestapo had knocked at the door asking for Imogene's father. Her mother hid him in the closet, and the Gestapo went looking for somebody else. Shortly thereafter, Imogene and her family made their way to the U.S. In Germany, Imogene's father had been a banker. In North Conway, New Hampshire, her parents had to find another way to make a living.
We purchased a small rundown inn. My mother learned to cook, and they ran that inn successfully, fairly successfully, for years and years.
Even as they were first getting established, Imogene's parents were determined to make their first Christmas in the U.S. memorable.
I got my skis, little wooden skis, was just thrilled and delighted. Walked up to Cranwell Mountain with some friends, and we started skiing. You walk up a ways to, I remember the boulder that we walked up to and went back down. It would get cold, and most of my friends would go into the warming hut, have some hot chocolate, and I was just driven to climb back up that little hill and ski down again, and probably fall down at the bottom, but just determined to keep trying.
Keep that determination in mind. It paid off. But for the moment, think about being an 8-year-old, newly relocated German kid in New Hampshire in 1940.
We were the only German family in that little town, and it was quite difficult to make our way. People were somewhat suspect of us in terms of Nazis, spies, etc., etc.
Young Imogene was fortunate to have parents who protected their children from the ugliness and harassment they sometimes encountered as adults, and perhaps she was also fortunate that neither of her parents was inclined to try skiing. Without parental misguidance, she found a role model elsewhere.
I do remember being maybe in the fifth or sixth grade, and there was a woman from North Conway. Her name was Paula Kahn.
Paula Kahn represented the U.S. in the 1948 Olympics, but even before that experience, she had stories for the youngsters in that New Hampshire school.
She came to talk and play the accordion and yodel. And I was enthralled by her. She talked a little bit about her skiing, that she had been in Colorado to race, and suddenly I thought, that would be absolutely my dream, is to do what Paula has done.
The dream seemed unlikely. Imogene hadn't started skiing as early as a lot of her classmates had. She was persistent, but would that be enough? A few years later, she began to find out.
I tried out for the Kennett High School Conway ski team, and I was the only girl selected for that.
After high school, Imogene enrolled at the University of New Hampshire. During the winter of 1950, she met an older ski racer who mentioned that she might want to try out for the Olympic team.
And I said, I could never. I'm not nearly good enough. At the time, mountains in the east did not offer the kind of terrain that I would need to train on. So I took a year off from college, again with the support of my parents, and went to Sun Valley, Idaho.
Sun Valley had not only the terrain, but the coaches who could turn aspiring skiers into Olympians. Imogene Fish waited tables between the races that would determine who'd go to the 1952 Olympics in Norway. Fish won the first such event, but before the second, she came down with the flu and learned that the team manager had some common sense.
I was going to get out of bed and get myself in that race even with 104 temperature, but she said, Imogene, the kind of people we want on this team are more sensible than that. So I missed that race, but then did fine in the remaining two. Lo and behold, at the end of the winter and after the final race, I had indeed made the team.
Imogene called home. Her parents were understandably proud and then some.
I think they were more interested in me going to the Olympics and perhaps beating some of the German skiers than they were anything else. They would never confess to that, but...
So the idea was, you don't necessarily have to come home with a medal, but please beat the Germans.
Yes, yes, and I did beat a few of the Germans, but a couple of them beat me, so...
Lovely, and simple, too. A happy ending for a young skier and two proud parents a dozen years after they fled the temporary insanity of the country where they were born to thrive in the U.S. Except that, as Imogene Fish recalled, her story, like most stories, was not as simple as it might have seemed.
My mother had left a son from a different marriage in Germany who was in the German army and so could not come to the U.S. with us, who was then missing in action in Stalingrad. I just feel that they had been seen through so much that they just felt blessed that something this wonderful would happen to them, that the country they had chosen had then chosen their daughter to represent them. And it was just very satisfying for them.
After Imogene Fish returned from Oslo, she enrolled at Mount Holyoke, where she's in the Athletic Hall of Fame. She built a career in education, raised a family, and helped set up an integrated school and summer camp during the civil rights movement. 3 years ago, for a profile that appeared in a Mount Holyoke publication, she was asked if she had any advice for aspiring Olympians. If you're going to do well, she said, you have to go a little bit faster than you think it's probably smart to do. We originally aired this story on Imogene Fish in January of last year. This week, Imogene Fish carried the torch for an Olympics-themed exercise program at North Hill, the senior community where she lives, and she downplayed her honorary role, telling me, I do it every couple of years. Last April, Olympic bobsledder Stephen Holcomb talked about the day in 2007 when he attempted to take his own life.
If I just end it now, it solves so many problems. To me, it was completely logical. That's what's scary about depression is you just end up doing crazy things.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of North Korea's spectacularly ruinous response to the Olympics staged by their neighbor to the south in 1988. But right now, it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
In the ongoing Olympics, some of the favorites have prevailed. Chloe Kim and Michaela Schifrin are among the athletes who were expected to excel, and they have done that, except when Michaela Schifrin didn't. So no sure things, right?
Absolutely not. I thought we were going to start right off with snowboard cross or skeleton, my two favorite events.
They are alarming in the extreme every time
snowboard
I see
snowboard cross, baby. I'm telling you, roll bandages. I love that thing. And short track.
Among the intriguing backstories is Mirai Nagasu's work history, Charlie. Ms. Nagasu helped the U.S. figure skating team win a bronze medal in the team competition, and in doing so became the first U.S. woman to land a triple axel at the Olympics. She had previously skated in a Colorado Avalanche jersey.
That's right. She was an ice performer for the Colorado Avalanche.
I refused
to use the word ice girl because it's demeaning. But as in all great stories, somewhere at the heart of this one is hockey.
Just days before the bobsled competition was scheduled to begin, there was a dispute over who owned the sled the Jamaican women's team would use. What is this all about?
Well, the coach quit.
Yeah.
And having quit, threatened to take the sled away.
It's my ball and I'm picking up my sled and taking it home.
Luckily, though, Red Stripe Beer stepped in and bought the sled for the Jamaican women, so they will slide.
That's good. And they don't have to slide down the chute on a loner.
That's exactly right.
That's good.
Or on a rug.
which might be entertaining.
Well, yeah,
albeit slower.
I don't want to give them any more ideas.
You covered the 1988 Olympics, also in South Korea, correct?
I did.
And you followed these games from home base. Do you find yourself wishing you were in South Korea this time around?
Yes, because I've never covered a Winter Olympics, and I have always wanted to. Because, let's face it, Bill, this is where the maniac sports car. This is where the maniac sports go to play.
So nothing crazier than going downhill fast.
I love the Winter Olympics because it always seems like they made up the event five minutes before they came on television. I mean, how does somebody come up with snowboard cross?
I love it. LeVar Ball, the father of three young basketball players, announced that if the Lakers, for whom his oldest son, Lonzo, currently plays, don't sign his other two sons, LeVar is going to find an NBA team that will employ all three of them. The Lakers have got to be at the point where they regret signing Lonzo Ball.
Not just that, but I mean, there is no NBA team that is going to put all three, even if they were great, which they're not, the three Ball brothers together and have to put up with Pops. There's no chance of that. He's going to have to start his own franchise.
The Atlanta Hawks are in the bottom of the NBA's Eastern Conference, but they're scoring big points with a couple who met during a team-sponsored Tinder night, and now the Hawks are hosting their wedding celebration and paying the bill for the whole thing. Playoffs, no matchmaking future, yeah!
This has been a huge thing in professional sports this week. The Vegas Golden Knights
had your favorite team.
My favorite team did one of those, you know, put the proposal up on the screen. And those people got married that night.
I hope they were planning on doing it anyway. I really hope they at least knew each other. Sidney Crosby scored his 400th goal last Sunday. Pretty good for 13 seasons.
Yeah. If you had asked me to bet, I would not have bet that Sidney Crosby's been in the league for 13 years. Mm. That's pretty amazing.
Context is all. And yeah. If we want to talk about people who've really scored a lot of goals, I think Sidney Crosby is number 95.
Yeah, he's getting there, though. Don't worry about it.
This week, Notre Dame lost 21 football games that they had played 5 and 6 years ago. How'd that happen?
It had to vacate the football wins from 2012 and 2013 because a student trainer was found to have done some homework for two Notre Dame players and provided, quote-unquote, impermissible academic benefits to another six. So there was some academic fraud going on here, but it sure took a long time to settle down. I would like to confess now for the record that when I was a college student, I used to write papers for money for people in, like, engineering school who didn't know how to write. So yeah. I don't want the 1977 NCAA championship to be taken away because I didn't do it for any basketball players.
Well, but there's got to be an engineering championship in there
somewhere. I did it for some schmoes in the engineering school.
Finally, Charlie, there didn't seem to be anything odd about Suleiman Al-Fahim of Abu Dhabi acquiring the English soccer team in Portsmouth back in 2009. Lots of wealthy folks from that part of the world own teams in the UK and elsewhere. But the owner's wife checked her bank statements and, oops.
Several $1 million were missing. First of all, can I just say that Abu Dhabi is the country that is the most fun to say in the world? Anyway, the Abu Dhabian looted his wife's bank account to buy the team, hoping to flip it so fast that she wouldn't notice. And now he's going to go to FIFA jail, wherever that is.
You can find the sport at FIFA jail. It's almost as much fun to say as Abu Dhabi.
That's right. I think it's in the Phantom Zone.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
About a year ago, independent filmmaker Brett Rapkin started noticing blurred vision in his left eye. At first, he thought it was no big deal, but it turned out he was suffering from keratoconus, a degenerative eye condition that, in severe cases, requires a cornea transplant. Rapkin's search for a less invasive treatment led him to a story he needed to tell about Olympic athletes and mental health. Here's reporter Tal Pinchevsky.
Brett Rapkin's search for treatment of his keratoconus eventually brought him to the office of Dr. Brian Boxer Wachler. A specialist based in Beverly Hills, Dr. Boxer Wachler had pioneered a treatment known as the Holcomb C3R procedure.
He had used this procedure on Stephen Holcomb, who had become legally blind while being the captain of the U.S. bobsled team. He had Stephen's book in his waiting room, which is called But Now I See, and I would read it in chunks while I was waiting for my appointment, and I was blown away by the story.
Here's the story as NBC told it at the 2010 Vancouver Olympics.
Steve Holcomb is about 51 seconds away from erasing 62 years of frustration.
The United States hadn't won a gold medal in the four-man bobsled since 1948. Bobsled is a team event, but during the broadcast, it was clear the focus was on the face of the U.S. bobsled program, driver Stephen Holcomb.
He got through 50-50 clean, 93 miles per hour. Steve Holcomb has raced for gold!
But it was the story of what happened before Holcomb's historic gold medal that most fascinated Brett Rapkin. In 2007, Holcomb attempted to kill himself by ingesting 73 sleeping pills and washing them down with a bottle of Jack Daniels. Rapkin had his next film idea.
Our plan was to tell the inspiring story of a guy who had survived that, miraculously woken up, gotten his legal blindness fixed, and won a gold medal.
Rapkin reached out to the Olympic champion, and Holcomb agreed to an interview. They spoke last April.
He showed up to the interview. He was an incredibly friendly guy, soft-spoken, doesn't look like your typical Olympian, kind of stocky. We had dinner in Santa Monica, chatted for a bit, and the next day we did the interview. It lasted, I want to say, close to 3 hours, and there were some pretty emotional moments.
Holcomb talked about what it was like to have been losing his eyesight while still competing. He actually kept the condition secret, knowing that it could potentially cost him his career.
It's scary, and I had to withdraw from my friends and my family and society in general, and just really kind of became closed off, and I kind of slipped into a depression knowing that this was inevitable and it was going to happen.
He was putting himself and his teammates' lives at risk every time he drove down the bobsled course. You combine that with his own mental health challenges that are probably genetic, and it became an unbearable situation for him.
Just made sense to me. I mean, it just made sense that if I just end it now, it solves so many problems and everything will just get better. And I'll be doing people a favor. They won't waste their money on me. They're not gonna waste their time. And then my eyes are going bad. Like, I don't wanna go blind. So I just kind of, killing 10 birds with one stone. And it just seemed like, to me, it was completely logical. And it made sense, and that's what's scary about depression is that stuff does make sense, and you just end up doing crazy things. So I ended up, I had a whole bunch of sleeping pills on hand. That should have worked. I don't know why it didn't work. It should have worked, and maybe there's something else I'm meant to do.
We talked about that, at length, and he was quite emotional, in particular, talking about how it would have affected his mom and his family if he hadn't survived his attempt. And he talked about how grateful he was to have survived and that he could tell his story.
After the gold medal in 2010, Holcomb went on to win 2 bronze medals in Sochi, both of which could be upgraded to silver depending on what happens with the Russian doping scandal. When he sat down with Rapkin, Holcomb was just 10 months away from going to South Korea for what he expected would be his last Olympic Games. He'd been competing for the U.S. since 1998 and didn't know what he was going to do next.
After he went to Pyeongchang, he was going to have to move into his mom's basement and figure out the rest of his life. That was his headspace a few months out from the Winter Games. And 12 days later, I got a call from his longtime agent that he was dead.
On May 6, 2017, Holcomb was found dead in his room at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Lake Placid, New York. He was 37. A preliminary report from the local coroner found a lethal combination of alcohol and sleeping pills in his system.
There was no indication to me that he wanted to harm himself. He was excited about teammates that were returning. He was excited about some new equipment that he had gotten for his bobsled. He had so much that he was looking forward to. And his family and friends feel very strongly that his death was not intentional. So we may never know exactly how he died, but we know that he was someone who had suffered.
as we cheer for these young men and young women, as we become fascinated in their personal journeys and their stories, I think it's also important to recognize their humanity.
This is Dr. Scott Goldman. He is a licensed clinical psychologist and the director of the Performance Psychology Center at the University of Michigan. In more than a decade of working with athletes, Dr. Goldman has seen firsthand the unique challenges facing Olympians, who remain mostly anonymous except for a two-week window that comes every 4 years.
What you see is just a roller coaster ride, right? Like it is training hard, world championships, training hard, Olympic trials, training hard, Olympic events. And that roller coaster is an onslaught on the senses. They are just going, 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 going. And then when it ends quickly. I think many of them are really just exhausted and they just need a recovery period.
After Holcomb's death, Brett Rapkin decided to expand his project to speak to other Olympic athletes about their struggles with depression and the after effects of competition. And soon, athletes started reaching out to him.
So I basically got on the phone with Brett. I just thought this was such an important story.
That's Sasha Cohen. She won silver in ladies figure skating in Torino. And while she's never been diagnosed with depression, she's experienced the pressures of being an Olympian. That pressure only intensified heading into those 2006 games, where she was considered a medal contender following her Olympic debut in 2002.
It's really difficult. I remember one summer, it was the 4th of July, I went with my trainer to the track where we did sprints, and I just knew that my family and my friends, they were all, you know, on a beach in California, like having a barbecue and being social and watching fireworks. And I was in the midst of like 100-degree summer, just feeling so nauseous from the sprints and so alone. My mom was a big support for me, so I would call her. You know, I think on that day I called her crying, and I was like, I don't want to be here, and like, why am I here, and this is so hard. There are moments like that. There are so many moments like that when you're training, but you tell yourself it's fine, it's just today.
But Cohen's most challenging moments came after she stepped away from the ice. After dedicating her life to her Olympic pursuit, she enrolled at Columbia University in search of a new purpose.
You know, I went to a career fair at Columbia and I checked out every booth and employer and tried to get a feel for what the jobs were, what I'd be doing, trying to imagine myself there. It was strange, you know, I was 30, everyone else was 20, 21, and it's just a very different life from what I'd come from.
Those struggles have become the subject of a podcast Cohen is working on, where she interviews others who've also had to reinvent themselves. Sasha Cohen is just one of the Olympic athletes who have told Rapkin their story. He's also spoken to former Olympic skier and NFL player Jeremy Bloom, as well as swimming legend Michael Phelps, who has been very open about his own struggles with depression since retiring from the pool as the most decorated athlete in Olympic history.
Every single athlete I've talked to, some of who still have strong affiliations to the USOC, have been not just willing, but enthusiastic about telling me that we need more help.
It's these stories and the countless more like them that Rapkin plans on compiling in his film, The Weight of Gold. As the film project has evolved over the past year, Rapkin has not forgotten about Stephen Holcomb, whose spirit still serves as an inspirational force.
Stephen was roughly my age. You know, he was in his late 30s. It's bizarre. You know, I mean, I had dinner with the guy. I spent an entire day working with him, talking with him. We went and filmed his eye doctor checkup. It's still totally shocking that he's not around.
That story comes to us from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. Filmmaker Brett Rapkin hopes The Weight of Gold will be the first film in a trilogy he's calling The Headcase Project. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa. And our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.